Talk Shoes.
Recorded live.
Good morning. Today is Tuesday, September 24th, 2013. This is John Friend, and you are listening to The Realist Report here on Talk Shoe. Thanks for tuning in today. My website is john-friend.net, and you can contact me via email at john.robert.friend@gmail.com, or you can find me on Facebook. Be sure to visit AmericanFreePress.net, and I do encourage you to subscribe to America's last real newspaper. If you make a minimum $10 donation to American Free Press, you will receive a free one-year online subscription. So again, be sure to visit AmericanFreePress.net for more details. And today I have a very special guest, a returning guest. His name is John DeNugent, and he's a longtime pro-white activist and scholar. John and I will be discussing an article he wrote for the January-February 2008 edition of the Barnes Review entitled Oswald Spengler versus Adolf Hitler, a comparison of the varying beliefs of two Teutonic nationalists. And I do highly recommend subscribing to the Barnes Review as well. It is a bi-monthly historical magazine affiliated with American Free Press, and it truly is a world-class publication. So be sure to visit barnesreview.org for more details. So, John, welcome to the program. How are you this morning?
Just fine, thank you. We have beautiful weather. We have California weather, my friend. That is, we have a gorgeous azure skies, zero humidity. We are bathed in golden sunshine. And I must confess, the only thing I don't like about Western Pennsylvania is it rains like Portland or Seattle normally.
I see. I love it. It barely ever rains out here in California, at least where I'm at.
Oh, okay. Well, we get nothing but rain. Actually, we are very close to Seattle in terms of rainfall, but everything is just green and wonderful out here. But we have had a few little floods in the basement. I had 3 inches of water in my basement a couple of weeks ago, and that weren't no Perrier in there either. It's all the runoff from everywhere. And if anybody's been, I've been through a flood also in New Orleans. I live next to the Napoleon Canal in that very Frenchified city, and I went through a flood, and I'll never forget that. We had once a raft of fire ants float right toward me, or toward my neck as I was wading into 5 feet of water, and they were on a raft on leaves, dried leaves, and there was, discarded oil, motor oil containers and wood and all kinds of stuff. When there's a flood, nasty stuff was floating around, believe you me. And, of course, all the furniture has to go. The wooden paneling has to be ripped out, stuff that is soaked, and people just throw it away. So, but we have a beautiful day today, and it's a privilege to be back on your show. I love your show. I love your personality. I love the content you put out also, so I'm very happy to be back with you.
Well, thanks. I appreciate that. And today I wanted to talk about the article you wrote for the Barnes Review a few years ago, comparing Oswald Spengler and Adolf Hitler. I was actually reading Willis Cardo's book. Well, it's actually edited by Michael Collins Piper, but it's essentially a compendium of all the writings of Willis Cardo, and he was talking quite a bit about Oswald Spengler. And I really didn't know too much about this man until I read that book, and I actually did a Google search, and I found your article on the internet. And I'll be posting a link to a PDF copy of this article, which you can find at democratic-republican.us, which is your website. So people can go over there and take a look at this article and read it. It's not terribly long. I think it's only about 3 pages long. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, democratic-republicans, plural.
Republicans.
Plural, yeah. That was the name of Thomas Jefferson's political party, and 5 presidents of the United States were Democratic Republicans. And it's kind of appropriate because it was both, Thomas Jefferson was both left-wing and right-wing. He believed in helping the common man, but he also had sort of an aristocratic view that most people are cowardly, dumb slobs, and people have to work their way if they want to rise to the top. He didn't believe in natural equality. He believed in equality of opportunities, and that's what would define America in his view. So 5 presidents of the United States were Democratic Republicans. The last one was the great Andrew Jackson. The first one was Thomas Jefferson. So that's why I call it democratic-republicans.us.
Excellent. Well, we've seen how the word equality has been totally transformed thanks largely to our Jewish media and our Jewish culture.
Well, it certainly has. And, of course, you're living out there in Los Angeles.
I'm actually in San Diego County.
Just south
of Los Angeles, yep.
Well, when I was there, I was working for Willis Carto. I helped people who wanted to set up their own revocable trust to leave money to the cause, to our cause. And we had a nice little deal that we would provide them with paperwork and so forth and take them through a notary. If they wanted to just leave 3% of their estate when they were, you know, getting older, and just would save them about 10% in the cost of lawyers and courts after they die going to probate courts. We had a good deal. And I was down in San Francisco a lot down then. There used to be a lot of great patriots in Southern California, all of it. And it was an overwhelmingly white city back then, although a lot of Mexicans to the south of San Diego. But it was a right-wing Republican bastion. And your mayor, Pete Wilson, was very much opposed to illegal aliens. And he really stood up to them. I think he was the last California governor who did. And it was a wonderful city with a fabulous zoo. And, of course, I was in the Marines. You had a Marine Corps boot camp, San Diego boot camp. Mm-hmm. And, of course, a giant, amazing Navy base out there also with the aircraft carrier. So San Diego is a very interesting city.
It is, yeah, and you know, it's known as America's finest city, and it truly is a wonderful city, but it has definitely changed over the years, and yeah, it's certainly not the same city as when you were out here, that's for sure.
Yeah, more Mexicanos?
Yeah, lots of Mexicans. There's all sorts of refugees in general. There's a neighborhood that, if anybody does a Google search for City Heights, San Diego, I'm sure they can find some information about this. I mean, the neighborhood is literally, it's like you're walking into Africa or something. I mean, there's immigrants from all over the world, mostly Somalians, lots of Southeastern Asians, Vietnamese, Cambodians. I mean, really people from all over the world. And it's just amazing. You know, we have this very sort of liberal mindset where we have to be compassionate, and we have to let all these people into our countries to help them, and it's totally backwards. I was just reading an article, actually, and I didn't even realize this. I mean, I knew that immigration in the United States is totally out of control, but I didn't realize this. Apparently, the United States lets in more immigrants than all of the countries of the world combined on a yearly basis. We let in more immigrants, I'm talking legal immigration here. We let in more legal immigrants to the United States than the entire world combined. That is an amazing fact.
Well, it's incredible. And, of course, it's a large country. It's several million square miles, if you include Alaska, of course. But it's getting crowded. The East Coast up to the Mississippi River is getting not as crowded as Europe, but it's getting there. And there's a megalopolis from Boston all the way down to really Richmond, Virginia. It's just solid people.
Mm-hmm.
It's about 60 million people all wedged in together. So we're, you know, and when a country gets crowded and overpopulated like that, people become more tense. And I don't think white people really thrive in an environment like that.
Mm-hmm.
I really don't think they thrive. I think they're unhappy. I think they're unhappy when kind of like, you know, the certain animals, which you stick them in a zoo, they won't breed anymore. They say they refuse to breed in captivity. And I think white people need to see green plants and blue skies. They need to see oceans or lakes and rivers. They need to be able to go hunting and fishing and tend their gardens. We're a little bit more of a loner race that needs to have time by ourselves. And if you wedge us in together, I think we become unhappy.
Mm-hmm.
And we retreat. I think we drink too much alcohol or smoke pot or we withdraw because we're not people the way I think blacks are or other races.
Mm-hmm. I certainly think our quality of life diminishes as you know, you become more and more populated and population concentrates. I think that there's no doubt about that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I'm eager to talk with you about Oswald Spengler.
Yeah. You know what I'd like to do real quick? Maybe I could just read, because I honestly didn't know a whole lot about Oswald Spengler, and the very first couple paragraphs of your article kind of, you know, give a little background of him, and then we can go from there. So let me just start off by reading the first couple paragraphs of your article. And again, I'll have this linked on my website once I post this show. And the article is entitled Oswald Spengler versus Adolf Hitler, a comparison of the varying beliefs of two Teutonic nationalists. And the subheadline says, Oswald Spengler is sometimes said to be a forerunner of Adolf Hitler. However, such an assessment would not be accurate. Both were great men, but in many important ways, their thinking, in fact, could not be more opposing. And let me just go ahead and, like I said, I'll just read the first few paragraphs here. And it says, starts off, Oswald Spengler, 1880 to 1936, was a German philosopher whose reputation rests almost entirely on his masterwork, The Decline of the West, in two volumes published in 1918 and 1922, a major contribution to social theory. After taking his doctorate in 1904, Spengler worked as a schoolmaster and tutor until 1911, when he went to live in Munich and began working on The Decline of the West. The first volume won him immediate acclaim from the public. The second volume followed in 1922, and a revised edition of the first came out a year later. Spengler contended that because civilizations pass through a life cycle, not only can a historian reconstruct the past, but he can also predict the spiritual forms, duration, rhythm, meaning, and product of the still unaccomplished stages of history. In other words, one can predict the future, the decline and fall of our Western civilization, for example. Unlike historian Arnold Toynbee, who later held that cultures are usually apparented or linked to other cultures, Spengler contended that the spirit of one culture could never be transferred to another culture. He believed the West had already passed through the creative state of culture into that of reflection and material comfort, which he called civilization, and that the future, therefore, could only be one of irreversible decline for the Occident. There was no prospect of reversing the process, since civilizations blossom and decayed like natural organisms, and true rejuvenation was impossible in one case as in the other. So he was sort of a historical determinist, I think you could say. He viewed Western civilization's decline and ultimate destruction as inevitable. Is that correct, John?
Yes, he did. It just so happens that Margaret, my fiancée, was just over in Germany and France, and very productive visit with a number of important comrades and accomplished some important tasks. One of the things she did on my behalf was she met with the great French white nationalist author Hervé Riesen. Hervé, H-E-R-V-E, with an accent on it. It's like our English word Harvey. Our English word Harvey actually comes from the French word, because in Norman Conquest, English and French have many words in common. Hervé has just written a new book called The Eschatological War. It's about how different cultures see what could be called the end times. The Jews have very strong belief about what will happen at the end of the world, and how the Jewish Messiah will come. He will conquer the world for the Jews. The Muslims also have a belief that their Messiah, called the Mahdi, he will come and he will kick ass, and then the world will have to obey the Muslims. The Christians have a belief, of course, that Jesus has already come, but he'll come again, and he'll smush the wicked, and so forth. There are two kinds of pagan views about what happens in history. And Hervé Riesen is very, very condemnatory of Oswald Spengler and of others he considers to be just like him for preaching what he calls pessimism. The other people that he throws in with Oswald Spengler are Julius Evola, who was an important Italian thinker. Everybody agrees he was an important thinker, pro-white and pro-Western. René Guénon, a French thinker. Alain de Benoist of the French New Right, who's been well known for about 40 years in white nationalist circles, and others, And what they all preach is there's a cycle of rise and fall to each civilization. And it's rough and ready and crude and rude, but has vitality and force and adventure and manhood. Okay, so you conquer the world and settle the frontier, fight the Indians or the Huns or whoever, defeat your enemies, and you establish your empire. Okay, then you become rich and fat and arrogant, and you hire slaves to do all the work for you, and then you become in love with money, sex, comforts, and you're no longer you've lost that edge. And then the slaves start to rise in your place because they still have to work hard and they still live on the street and they have to be tough and have street smarts and they have to stay aggressive to survive. And then the previous ruling class becomes fat and decadent. And then, of course, comes the downfall and it's overthrown.
Now, there's something to that theory, though, it seems like, and throughout history, you can recognize these patterns.
Well, it's certainly true.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is, and Hervé Riesen says, that all these people, Spengler, Evola, René Guénon, and there are several others, and he really, really attacks them brutally in this book, which I think he's been wanting to get off his chest for a long time, because he says it's paralyzing the white nationalist movement in France. What they're saying is, to be blunt, we have to let Western society crash and burn and a huge catastrophe happen, because only that will wake people up. And then a new form of civilization will rise from the ashes, like the phoenix, like
mm-hmm.
the splendid bird. Okay, so first we have to have the crash. So if you try to stop the downfall of America or the white race or our Western civilization, then you are fighting against the inevitable laws of history. And so he doesn't use this phrase, but I use it. It's from Catherine Austin Fitz. She was a Wall Street tycoon, and then she turned against the New World Order. And she has a great phrase. She calls it a positive cover story. In other words, your motives for choosing what to do or to refuse to do may be just cowardice and greed, but you invent a noble-sounding interpretation of what you're doing. Like, well, I'm just letting the cycles of history play out. That's why I'm not fighting the Jews. That's why I'm not sticking my neck out. That's why I'm not an activist. Because you don't get it. We have to let the Jews win so, like a boomerang, we can make our comeback. And as Hervé Riesen says, well, suppose the entire white race is exterminated or race mixed to the point we all look like no-neck Mexicans. How are we going to make a comeback then when our gene pool is gone, buddy? And he's really furious because he sees people. You could say to them, you're just being a friggin' coward. And you refuse to talk. All these people refuse to talk about the Jews. Oh, and another one he attacked was Nietzsche. He said, you go easy on the Jews. Oh, and all of them bash Christianity. All of them bash Christianity. If we just got to get rid of the Catholic Church, we're going to get rid of Jesus. You know, they're wimping us out. They're wussing us out. And he says, you people are the wusses. Jesus died fighting the Jews. And says many Christians died for their beliefs. So you're not willing to fight for anything. Stop bashing Christianity. And the real enemy is the Jews, because of all the psychopathic groups around the world, the Jews are the most tightly organized, well-funded, and millennial conspiracy. The Jews have vast experience in defeating their enemies more than, you know, an individual psychopath like Donald Trump or Bill Gates or, you know, these various, the Italian mob, the various bad guys around the world. They're little league compared to the Jews in terms of psychopathic professionalism.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and Spengler, he actually was against the sort of racial and I guess, you know, how Hitler talked about the Jews as essentially being the opponent of the Aryan man. He was sort of against this thinking.
Yeah. Well, Hitler was very much against that, because Hitler was very much in favor of optimism based upon many of us have seen the famous movie by Leni Riefenstahl from 1934, The Triumph of the Will. He believed that willpower, and not just a determination, but he believed in the cleansing power on your nervous system of the belief in victory. We will win in the end because the Aryan man is unstoppable. And Hervé Riesen says in his book, The Eschatological War, meaning, you know, the war between the different views about what's going to happen to our civilization. In this book, he says, the Jews are empowered by this belief. And I'll need to go into it in just a little bit of little bit of detail.
Sure.
They believe the Jews must conquer the world through money, and then their Messiah will come, and then they'll annihilate their foes. And 1,000, every Jew will have 1,000 goy slaves and live in incredible wealth. In fact, the chief Orthodox rabbi of Israel said this a couple of years ago. He says, we will live as effendi, which is a Turkish word meaning the master, who just sits at his banquet table all day, and 1,000 slaves and slave women are at his beck and call. And each Jew will live like a sultan after the Messiah comes. But if the Jews work hard, and every Jew works for the triumph of the Jewish race, then the Messiah will come, and then they will cleanse the planet of all their enemies. So the Jews believe 100% they will take over the world, and then their Messiah will come, and then they'll completely annihilate or enslave all the goyim, which is us. Islam also believes the Mahdi will come after we have spread Islam throughout the world, and then we will deliver the coup de grace to the unbelievers. There is, in all these religions, a certainty we will win because God is backing us.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But if you have a pessimistic worldview, like Nietzsche or Spengler, Western civilization is going to crash and burn, and you know, but that's okay because we will be noble, lonely people moaning and writing poems to each other and remembering how we used, our civilization used to be full of heroes who slew the Moors and the Turks and the Huns, and we conquered the world and we went into space. And boy, we were a great race, weren't we? He says this pessimistic defeatist teaching. What Hervé Riesen says is you're just kidding yourself. This is your positive cover story for all your gilding your instinct for cowardice and giving up. So in other words, the Jews are one quarter, John, of 1% of the human race. Now, why the F are they beating us if they are one quarter of 1% of the human race? This is like two scrawny Jew cowboys shove open the saloon doors of a bar, a saloon in the Wild West. Okay, and 400 cowboys get up and run out the back door.
Yes. Well,
that's what's happening right now.
Well, John, in your opinion, why are they winning?
Well,
why have they been so successful? Their agenda is literally clicking on all cylinders at this point. Why have they been so successful?
Well, I believe I'll just give you a blunt and headline word to answer.
Sure.
I'll just quote from I'll quote from a great guy named Jesus of Nazareth in the Gospel of John, chapter 8, verse 44. He said to the Jewish leaders, and, you know, every people is led by its leaders. They form it and lead it to where it's going, and they energize it and mobilize it and whip it up with speeches and sacred writings and the accoutrements of their culture. Jesus said to the Jewish leaders, you are from your father, the devil, and you seek to do the lusts of your father. He was a liar and a murderer from the beginning. It says, the Jews are a satanic people. The Jews have the power of Satan. And yes, I'm going to come out on the radio right now. I believe in Satan. I believe in the devil. I believe that they're just as you and I are intelligent beings in the flesh. And there are serial killers. There are baby murderers. There are pedophiles. There are vicious Hollywood tycoons who are also in the flesh. They're evil. I believe that in other dimensions, there are souls who are extremely evil. And one of them, you might as well call him Satan. And I believe he has friends, and they are demons. I absolutely believe that there are evil spirits in other dimensions. And just as angels and God can help us, I believe there are evil beings. And I believe that the top Jewish leaders actually worship Satan.
Mm-hmm.
And they are getting power, occult power from Satan. The reason why I say it is this. I have my website, johndenugent.com. I have if you look under John Nugent for Sheriff, a tab at the very top, I have something called talking about Israel's war against humanity. And in there, I have a subsection on the Jewish war with the Kennedys, with the Kennedy family. The Kennedys were secretly extremely anti-Jewish. Now,
oh, yeah.
Let me cut to the chase here. A friend of mine named Bob Fisher, F-I-S-C-H-R.
Oh.
There's a very German settled state out there.
John, I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm sorry. You cut out for just a moment. You said you had mentioned you have a friend, Fisher.
Yeah, Bob Fisher, Robert Fisher.
Okay.
Yeah, from St. Louis, Missouri, very good German area. He's of German descent, F-I-S-C-H-E-R. He was a research chemist for DuPont until he was let go because, you know, you get to be 50 or 55. Corporate America will just let you go. They don't have to pay you a pension. They can hire some young Hindu or some Chinaman for a quarter of the salary, so they just put him out to farm it. And I got to meet him, and he was very mad. He had woken up to the New World Order, and he had done research on the assassinations and the accidental or not-so-accidental deaths of all these different Kennedys, you know, the so-called Kennedy curse. And many, many Kennedys died. Many Kennedys died in unfortunate ways. What he found out using Google Earth was that every major Kennedy who died, whether by assassination or a, quote, accident, unquote, and they were all secretly anti-Jewish. That's what's very, very important here. And I prove that in that whole thing. You just look at John Nugent for Sheriff and let that tab go down. So the Jews had it in for them. I mean, the patriarch, Joseph Kennedy Sr., was openly anti-Jewish.
His views were pretty clear on the Jewish question. He didn't hide his anti-Semitism.
Yeah, there's four long paragraphs about it in Wikipedia, mm-hmm. so he didn't hide it at all.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one reason why Franklin D. Roosevelt had his oldest son, who was even more handsome than John Kennedy was, murdered when his plane exploded. And President Roosevelt's son, Colonel Elliot Roosevelt, was piloting the plane just behind Joseph Kennedy Jr.'s plane when it magically exploded over the English Channel. Another amazing coincidence, the first of the murders of Kennedys by Jews and their minions. But here's the point. Every single Kennedy was killed when the Big Dipper was – it's kind of hard to explain if you don't understand astronomy and astrology, but the Jews are very involved with occult and black magic things. When the sign of Scorpio and the Big Dipper were both in the same alignment, and there are like six Kennedy murders or faked accidents, and they all happened – when Scorpio and the Big Dipper were lined up exactly. Now, this happened at different times of day, but this happened at different months out of the year, in different seasons of the year, but it was always that same exact configuration. Because what this means is, anybody can try to kill somebody, but the point, you know, is to get away with it and not be punished and have your whole conspiracy come out in the open courtroom and have people be hanged and executed and have a huge backlash against the Jews. So you have to kill somebody and hide who did it and spread terror and succeed in the purpose of your assassination, which is to eliminate your enemies and terrify everybody else. So the Jews use occult black magic science to take over the world. I actually believe exactly what Jesus Christ said. And anyone actually familiar with that famous quote from Jesus Christ? And if anybody knew about the Jews, it was Jesus. And he grew up in the Jewish culture. The Jews hated him. The Talmud is full of vicious attacks on Jesus Christ. I might add, for any of you who say, well, how do we know Jesus ever really existed? Maybe he was just invented. Well, the Talmud would have said that Jesus never existed.
Exactly.
Is full. I mean, if Jesus never existed, that would have been the first thing they would have written. Look at these Meshuggah Goyim worshiping a shepherd who never even existed. Mm-hmm. This proves how dumb the Goyim are. But they never said that. They said that Jesus walked in the water, Jesus healed the dead, Jesus performed all kinds of miracles. The Talmud admits Jesus performed miracles, and they admit he existed. So he did. He did both. He both existed and he performed miracles. The Talmud says that he learned black magic tricks while his family was in Egypt. Now, the New Testament itself says that Jesus' family did move to Egypt briefly because that's where they had to report for the Roman census. The Emperor Augustus was counting all of the citizens and residents of the Roman Empire for tax purposes. And you had to report to an area where the head of the family has been born to fill out your census form. So, you know, the Roman Empire is very organized, just like we have a census today. Our census comes from the ancient Romans doing censuses. So Jesus' family was in Egypt. And so the Talmud says Jesus learned black magic. In fact, they have a horrific story. Again, the Talmud doesn't deny Jesus exists. The Talmud obsesses on Jesus and says he existed. And they say he was wicked. They had this horrible story, but I'm going to tell it. They says that it's so sicko. I ask readers to pardon me for telling it, but it just tells you what the Talmud is full of.
No, it's important. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay,
I'm pretty familiar with all the disgusting and despicable things the Talmud says about Jesus. But yeah, tell
okay,
it.
Okay, so this goes. It's as bad as, you know, the claim that Jesus is being boiled alive in hell in liquids, in semen, or Jesus is being boiled alive in liquid feces. You know, this is the kind of stuff in the Holy Talmud. But here's another thing in the sacred Jewish writings. Okay, so Mary, his mother, she's opened up a trunk full of clothes, and she's rummaging around looking for something. Okay, so Jesus, being a wicked boy, he runs up and he slams this heavy trunk lid shut on his mother's breast, and he hops up on the lid of the trunk, and she's screaming in agony because her breasts are being clamped down on. And hey, folks, this isn't me. This is the Talmud talking here. Okay, so she says, "Son, why are you doing this?" He says, "Tell me all the secrets of black magic, and then I'll get off the lid." He says, "Son, how can you do this to me?" He said, "Tell me the secrets of the black magic of Egypt." And so she tells him, and then he hops off, and she's relieved from. So her own son tortures her to learn black magic secrets. This is what the Talmud says about Jesus. Now, this is a classic case of what, again, this French author, Hervé Risson, would call accusatory inversion. Every wicked and foul and disgusting and disgraceful and unspeakable thing that Jews do or dream of doing, that is exactly and precisely what, because they're aggressive and they want to get the jump on you, that's what they accuse you of. That's what they accuse their enemies of. If the Jews are pedophiles, then they accuse the Catholic Church of being full of pedophiles. If the Jews are obsessed with sex or they're thieves and they're greedy and evil, then they accuse us of all these things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they accuse Hitler of being a homosexual and of being a coward and of being a madman, all the things they are guilty of and of promoting. Well, they accuse their enemies.
And I mean, I think the prime example is World War II. You know, they say that the Germans committed a Holocaust when, in fact, the Jewish Bolsheviks and the Jewish-controlled Western allies committed the genocide against the Germans. I mean, it's literally the exact opposite of what they say. They say Muslims pulled off 9/11 when, in reality, Jews did 9/11.
Exactly. But you see, as Hervé Risson points out in this concept of accusatory inversion, it's not like an amazing coincidence that the Jews accuse us of their very own crimes. It's deliberate, but they accuse us first. So, for example, if I were to say to somebody on the street, there was never a German Holocaust of the Jews, there was a Jewish Holocaust of the Germans, and then the person is just mentally overwhelmed, like, huh?
Right.
What?
So are you saying that this tactic is a form of black magic?
Well, yes, it is, because
it's certainly a form of psychological warfare. There's no doubt about that.
Well, the Jews are a race of psychiatrists.
Right.
The Jews study us the way another life form would study a bug. I mean, if you and I, you know, stick a needle through a pin through a grasshopper and for a bug collection or a frog collection, you know, then you study it and you look at its little legs and you put your microscope on it, and they study us in the same way, or the way a tiger would study a gazelle crouching in the high grass. You just study your prey, and they study us. What makes us tick, what makes them tick, is hatred and the desire to rape and steal and lie and backstab and betray. And like the psychopathic race that they are, they just get off on our suffering, our tears, our disasters, and our tragedies. They
right.
love to cause them because they are a monstrous race of serial killers. And this is truly satanic. And so this is why Christ, I'm not a regular Christian, but I am a Christian in my own way, in the same way that Adolf Hitler was. And his intellectual mentor, his real mentor, was not Oswald Spengler. Hitler's mentor was the Englishman Houston Stuart Chamberlain, with his myth of the 19th century. And they both believed that Jesus really was a great man, and beyond that, probably some sort of divine messenger, that Jesus was from the other side. He was sent to awaken mankind to the great peril. So people say, well, why did Jesus grow up in the Jewish culture then? To know it from the inside. To know from the inside just how wicked it was. And when the Jews finally killed him, a man who preached peace and love and shedding the ego and forgiving and sharing and, for me, the greatest anecdote in the New Testament is the disciples are squabbling who should be the number one disciple after, you know, under Jesus. And Jesus comes in, he's disgusted. And so he takes a bowl of water and he kneels down and starts to wash the dusty feet of one of the disciples. That's what a servant or a slave would do. You come in a dusty, hot country like Palestine. It was very soothing. They'd massage your feet and they'd wipe them off and towel it off. And it was very, very refreshing. I had to just walk 3 or 4 miles on a stony, hot, dusty road. It was a great courtesy, but it was a very humble thing. You'd have a servant do that. So Jesus knelt down and he was washing their feet. And the disciple tried to withdraw his foot. He says, Master, I should be washing your feet. And then Jesus stood up and looked at them all and said, here you are debating which is the greatest. He says, let the greatest among you be the servant of the rest.
Very, very noble.
And if you want to be a teacher or a leader, remember, that's just a form of serving. And we all have our flaws. We're all sinners. We all have issues, personal issues to work on. So nobody should let any talent they have go to their head. So, and this man the Jews killed, tortured and killed, he was preaching love and unselfishness.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the opposite of Judaism.
Yeah.
In reality, Jesus created a new religion which can uplift white people as well as other races. And it's that's why it became a world religion, because people want to bury the hatchet. They want love. They want peace. They want to forgive and overlook insults and move beyond arguments and spats and infighting and hatreds and grudges and desires for vengeance. And our white nationalist movement needs that too.
Mm-hmm.
So Jesus was saying the Jews are possessed by the devil because their leaders are, and their leaders imbue them with the spirit they have. I believe that the top Jews actually sacrifice children to Satan the devil. Now, why do I say that? Because in 2007, wrote an extremely important book called Blood Passover. You can see it right now at a website called bloodpassover.com.
Now, John, I'm sorry,
very important.
You cut out for just a moment. This is a book by Ariel Toaff. Is that?
Yeah, Yeah, A-R-I-E-L, Ariel, kind of like
Ariel Toff.
Yeah, like the name of the mermaid in The Little Mermaid. I think her name was Ariel, too. A-R-I-E-L, T-O-A-F-F.
Yeah, and let me just say real quick, I actually covered this on a show with Dr. Harold Rome.
Oh, good.
Yeah, we discussed the long history of Jewish ritual murder, and it's actually pretty well documented. It's not, you know, the Jews like to say that it's just one of these blood libels, these conspiracy theories by these anti-Semitic racists that hate Jews, when in fact, it's actually very well documented.
Well, it's extremely well documented, and the greatest documentation of all is that the son of the Grand Rabbi of Rome,
exactly,
according to Wikipedia itself, Ariel Toaff, who was a tenured professor at Bar-Ilan University in Tel Aviv, an Orthodox Jewish university, by the way, and the son of the Grand Rabbi of Rome, the same Grand Rabbi with whom Pope John Paul II met in 1987 in a synagogue in Rome, which is the first time a pope had ever been inside a synagogue in like 2,000 years. That was the father of Ariel Toaff. That's how important this guy was. And Wikipedia itself says, Ariel Toaff is the world's leading authority on the history of Italian Jews from the Roman times up until modern times, through the brief persecution even that they had under Mussolini. So this man knew what he was talking about, the world's leading authority. And he details in a 130-page book with like 1 million footnotes and quotes in Latin and in Italian and transcripts from trials by the Inquisition and testimonies of various Jews. Ariel Toaff says 100% among the Ashkenazi, which is the Yiddish German-speaking Jews, the German, Polish, Russian, Ukrainian Jews, that group, there was definitely a tradition passed down secretly from father to son that you grab a Gentile child and you stab him to death with tiny little daggers up to 100 puncture wounds. You hold him upside down and you bleed him like in kosher slaughter while still alive and screaming. You circumcise him. You cut off his foreskin. The poor little baby boy is screaming horrifically, and you bleed him to death.
Ugh.
And the belief is, and Ariel Toaff, again, this is a tenured professor of Bar-Ilan University in Tel Aviv, Israel. This is the son of the Grand Rabbi of Rome. And he says the belief in all black magic is, if you perform the ritual correctly, then you force the demon to bestow favors upon you. In other words, you control the demon. Okay, we're bleeding this little Gentile boy to death as he's screaming. Of course, we're enjoying it, but, you know, still, I mean, these are the rules. Now, you, demon, must give us more wealth and more power and slay our enemies for us. That's the contract we have. We did this for you, now you must do this for us. And they call upon the demons by name. This is the essence of black magic, is that this is a low, like a dark angel. It does have powers. It's on the other side, and it can work and have its effects if you perform the ritual exactly as is written. In Ariel, 130-page scholarly book. So I believe that the top Jewish leaders actually engage in the ritual murder of our children. And you know, the interesting and stupid thing about it is, because of their belief that goyim, that is Gentiles, are animals, they're not allowed to bury the child that they have bled to death. The child's body must be tossed into a river, or it must be left in the forest for the animals to eat. Now, the big problem with that is, the body can then be found.
Yes.
And the strange thing is, it's a body without any blood in it. And then, in medieval times, and right up through our, you know, really modern times, people find the pressed out, squeezed out, emptied out body of a child with not a drop of blood left in it. If you see the whole child, you hold the child by its heels, just like the way the Jews and the Muslims slaughter cattle or pigs. They string them up by the heels. So the blood rushes down to the bottom of the body, which is where the brain and the heart are. So the heart keeps bleeding and pumping almost to the last minute of life. So you can actually squeeze out all the, I mean, this is horrible and sick and disgusting. But the point is, it keeps the victim alive until the very last heartbeat.
Talk about, I mean, this is just pure evil. I mean,
they did it
pure
to
evil.
Kids,
yeah.
They did it to children, but they also did it to a Catholic priest in the 1840s in Damascus, Syria. This priest was a friend to the Jews, and he would go in. He had certain medical skills. He would actually help to heal Jews who were sick, who were living in the little ghetto in Damascus, Syria. So they jumped him. They kidnapped him and they bled him alive and slit his throat and bled him alive. And he was their friend.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. Yeah. This is well documented and, you know, it's something that people need to think about and understand. I mean,
that's my case. I mean, if you even ritually bleed to death your friends who were sticking up for you,
what does that say about you?
It says, this is the heart of darkness.
Yes. Well, getting back to Spengler, he didn't have too much to say about the Jews, correct?
No, because he was a wuss.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
so,
the Jews had a lot of power in the publishing industry. If you wanted to get your book published and get favorable reviews in the Frankfurter Zeitung, which is like the New York Times of Germany back then, mm-hmm. or, you know, the Jews controlled about 60% of the newspapers in Germany back then. Spengler, like Ellen de Benoist and Julius Evola, who, by the way, Julius Evola in Italy wrote one book bashing the Jews, but by amazing coincidence, it was published during World War II in the year 1942. But all his books before then and after then, he left the Jewish question out.
Mm-hmm.
So they're just cowards. And Nietzsche bashed the Jews a little bit too, but most of his books, in the most cowardly and despicable way, are bashing Christianity and leaving the Jews alone.
Mm-hmm. Did Spengler, was he sort of an anti-Christian type as well?
Not overly. It wasn't his main target.
Mm-hmm.
He basically, his shtick or his gimmick or claim to fame was, I have discovered the immutable laws of history, which are civilizations rise and then they fall, and you can't stop them from falling, they have to crash and burn. Well,
so he was essentially just saying, you know, we got to sit back and just let this happen.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. And Adolf Hitler almost directly, well, without using the man's name, attacks Spengler mm-hmm. in both volumes of Mein Kampf. It also in
so
the
he,
book,
would he be characterized as sort of a pacifist that Adolf Hitler criticizes throughout Mein Kampf? This idea of pacifism and sort of I guess just being weak in general.
Well, what it really is I say, he says it's a positive cover story, but what both Hitler said and Hervé Riesen in this wonderful book, The Eschatological War, which is his sixth book. And by the way, Hervé Riesen is a graduate of the Sorbonne, which is the Harvard of France. He's a wonderful, wonderful. He's just a little bit over 40. He's a real street activist, too. He wears a leather jacket. He's tough as nails and hands out literature. He's been fined several times by French courts for many thousands of euros. He lives a very dangerous life. He is also an activist, handing out literature, going to demonstrations, shouting, screaming, running around and doing things. So Hervé is not some wuss who sits back there and just types in. He's not a keyboard commando.
Mm-hmm.
But Hervé, he talks the talk, and he talks a very good talk, but he also walks the walk of combat against our common chief enemy. And I have very, very high opinion. In fact, Margie and I are working on we're editing an interview which Margaret, my fiance, conducted with Hervé Riesen when she was in Paris about a month ago. But what Hervé Riesen is saying is it's really all about courage.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to be willing to die and lay your life down, as have many brave white men and women, for our freedom and for our power and survival and our safety for tens of thousands of years. Individual whites have volunteered to fight and die so the rest of us would be safe. And now we are called upon to make that ultimate decision, which goes against our
instincts
and face death and destruction and ruin or poverty or anything else that they can throw at us, character defamation and other things. So, you know, basically all of these people, it's a seductive song, John. It really is. It's we can't do anything about it. The Jews are going to destroy Western civilization. We're just going to be around to pick up the pieces and rebuild after it's all over. But there ain't going to be no white race when it's all over. There ain't going to be no white race. And people think, oh, well, I'm going to move to New Zealand. Well, guess what, my friend? I have people all over the world who read my blog at johnnugent.com, including many New Zealanders. You know what? The blacks are pouring into New Zealand. The Pakistanis are pouring in. The Chinese are pouring in. Perth, Australia is full. And not only that, Israel. The Prime Minister of New Zealand is a frigging Jew.
Yep.
And his daughter.
Yeah, there's no running. I mean, there's no running anywhere.
His daughter, his slut Jew daughter, just posed almost nude for a French fashion magazine.
Mm.
It's just the Jews are everywhere. There's no place you should run, and there's no reason why you should want to run and give up our territory.
Yep.
We need to develop a new ideology and strike back at these people. And that's my mission.
Yeah, well, you know, the ultimate Jewish agenda, I think, is not only sort of a material agenda where, you know, they literally would control, you know, the financing and the banking systems of the world and whatnot. But there's also a very real racial agenda. And there's a quote from the Jewish World, which is a newspaper, back in 1883. And I have this right here on my website, and I've talked about this on the air before, but let me just read it to you, because I think this kind of just nails what the ultimate Jewish agenda is. And it says, the great ideal of Judaism is that the whole world shall be imbued with Jewish teaching, and that a universal brotherhood of nations, a greater Judaism, in fact, all the separate races and religions shall disappear. They want to destroy any sort of national or racial consciousness throughout the entire world, but particularly in the white race.
Well, you know, every reason talks about this also, and this is why we've done this interview. He has many important and seminal thoughts. I think that even after we learn a lot about the Jews, we still have this wrong impression that the Jews just, like, feel resentment at Gentiles because they've been persecuted or they've been brainwashed into hating us. It's not that at all. Yeah, they hate us, and they've been brainwashed. But they actually have a clear-cut goal. Their goal is to create a master-slave planet.
Yes.
And they must destroy the religions, cultures, identities, traditions, and racial differences. We must all become café au lait people with no distinctions. An ocean of identical slaves.
Now, are you familiar with the book, The Jewish Utopia? It was written by a rabbi, I think,
out of Texas.
Yes,
yeah, it's terrifying.
Yeah, and I mean, again, this kind of speaks to the racial agenda. Yeah, they absolutely want to destroy. That's the Jewish idea of multiculturalism, where everybody's mixed, everybody's blended together in this consumerist, materialist world. You know, where all traditions and cultures and unique identities are destroyed. That's what they're trying to do. And they've been very successful, I got to say.
Well, you see, when the Jews greet each other, they say shalom. Well, shalom, which means peace. And, of course, in the Arabic word salam, they say salam aleikum, may peace be with you. Salam in Arabic, shalom in Hebrew, very important. What it means is peace. It's the peace of the cemetery, though. It's the peace of the slave who keeps his mouth shut. He works himself to the point of exhaustion, goes back to his barracks, and flops down on his bunk bed. That's peace for the Jews. It is the peace of the terrified slave. It's one giant gulag. And what you have to do is you have to annihilate all the leaders and any source of pride. For example, you know, you have all over the United States now you know, George Washington Elementary School or George Washington Junior High School. I used to teach at one of them in Alexandria, Virginia, or George Washington High School. You know, one by one, their name is being changed. Well, because, you see, he had slaves and he was a racist. And he had been,
exactly.
See, you Gentiles, we're going to debunk all your heroes. We're going to show you what scumbags all your heroes really were.
I think Karl Marx himself specifically said you have to destroy a people and to subjugate them, you have to destroy their history and their traditions and their heroes.
And their heroes. This is why, you know, the most favorite book of Adolf Hitler as a teenager, and you remember Adolf Hitler was a teenager in Vienna. Both his parents were dead. He was on the mean streets of Vienna, a city of 2 million people, Vienna, Austria.
Mm-hmm.
He lived
beautiful
in the
city. I've actually visited.
Yeah, but there were horrible slums back then. And he saw just moldy, musty apartments which never got sunlight. He saw prostitution. He saw drugs. He saw misery. He saw mm-hmm. tuberculosis. I mean, it was really like a nightmare out of Dickens, the Industrial Revolution. He lived in the slums. Hitler lived in the slums.
Mm-hmm.
And he saw how the working class people lived. He was really from farm and peasant families in the countryside. His father was middle class because he'd worked his way up in the civil service. But Hitler was from the country poor people, not from the city poor people. And when he saw what an urban slum, a white urban slum was like, anyways, he was shocked. But, sorry, I lost my train of thought.
Well, he also comments on sort of the multicultural nature of Vienna and how there were, you know, Poles and Romanians and Czechs and, you know, all these other, you know, ethnicities and nationalities in Vienna, and how he had, when he first encountered a Jew, he finally realized how totally alien a Jew was.
Well, it's interesting. August Kubitschek wrote an incredible book called
Hitler and Me, or Hitler and I, or something
Hitler,
like that.
Yeah, Hitler and I, or Hitler, My Friend in Youth, in German, out of Hitler, mein Jugendfreund, you know, like my friend in youth, like John Friend.
Or my young friend.
Yeah, yeah. His teenage friend was August Kubitschek, who went on to become a wonderful conductor, orchestra conductor, not a nationally famous one or internationally famous, like Herbert von Karajan or these others, but local symphonies. A wonderful man, loved Hitler. He just looked up to Hitler. He knew Hitler was going to be a star and a great man someday. He was a super loyal friend, and he would listen to Hitler. And Hitler would just expound, and it was just like sitting there at the foot of a genius, you know. And you knew Hitler was, you know, a little strange, a little eccentric, but Hitler was just destined for something awesome. And Kubitschek wrote a book. The Americans after World War II threw him in jail for 9 months. And they tried to figure out if they could charge him with anything, but they couldn't, because he never advocated Hitler's politics or policies. He just said, hey, we were friends when we were teenagers, and this is kind of stuff he would talk about, and we'd go to the opera together and this and that. But he said that, although it's not in the book, that the thing that upset Hitler the most was white slavery, sex trafficking. What would happen is the Jews had their agents out in the countryside, and they would tell some farm peasant girl, hey, you want to see the big city? You want to see Vienna? It's a world capital. You can be an au pair girl, or you can be a maid or a governess, and you can work in a mansion in downtown Vienna. And, oh, my God, Vienna is like the Garden of Eden. It's just culture and excitement and electric lights and telephones and trains and trolleys. And it's just such an exciting city. It's not like this little rural dump, you know, where you hear the cow mooing in the morning, and that's the most exciting thing that happened all day. You know, it's just, you can see the bright lights of the big city. So the country girl comes into Vienna. She's met at the train station by a Jew. They get into a carriage and off they go, but into a seedy part of town, not to a mansion. And so they take this girl into a bordello, back into a bordello, mm-hmm. and then they rape and beat her for 3 days. They stick objects up her vagina, up her anus and whatnot. They rape and humiliate and crush her like you would break a horse or something. They break the girl's spirit, mm-hmm. and then they keep her. They keep her locked up in the bordel. She can't leave. She's a prisoner. This is what these Jews do. And when Hitler learned,
they're doing the same thing today. I mean,
yes,
yeah,
today. And when Hitler learned, because Hitler had a very Hitler loved his mother. That's a very extremely touching poem about how he felt about his mom. And he was just grief-stricken when his mother died of breast cancer. He attended her for her final months. He was just doting son. And Hitler just put women on a pedestal. He respected, even though women were as cold and logical as men, but he just loved women for their beauty and their love and their kindness and compassion. And he loved the way his mother loved him. And Hitler put women on a pedestal. He believed women should be protected and cherished. When he learned what the Jews were doing to those Austrian country girls, and his own mother was a country girl, that's what did it for Hitler. That's when he decided someone must destroy the Jews.
Right. Yeah, and he had a thorough understanding of Jewish communism and Jewish capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
He really understood both of these ideologies and these systems as really just systems to exploit the goyim and exploit the host nations.
And it's not inconsistent. Some Jews like to destroy the goyim through stealing all the money through capitalism. Other Jews like to destroy society through Bolshevism. You know, to each his own. To each Jew, his own way to poison and destroy us. So, yes.
They both accomplish the same exact results.
And create a materialistic slave planet.
Mm-hmm.
A degraded planet. Again, as every Reason points out, it's H-E-R-V-E with a little accent, R-Y-S-S-E-N, and he's written six wonderful books, and I blogged about it quite a bit. He says, the Jews have a concrete political plan. We Jews must buy up the world and enslave it, and then our Messiah will come, and then we will slaughter billions of our enemies, and we will permit a few slaves to survive, and then each Jew will have 1,000 slaves who wait on him hand and foot. Of course, the female slaves can do other things for the Jew.
Right. Yeah, and, you know, I wanted to talk a little bit about Hitler's views on race, because I think if you actually read Mein Kampf, you'll recognize that Hitler was not some racial supremacist that the Jewish media in Hollywood would have you believe. He was just very matter-of-fact about the fact that the Aryan man largely has invented and created much of what we consider civilization today. All of the technologies, the architecture, you name it, really comes from the Aryan mind. And, you know, it's got me thinking, has the Jewish media and their control of technology today, do they have the ability to sort of replace this Aryan creativity that we've seen in history?
They don't, because creativity comes from two things which the Jews completely lack. First of all, as Goethe pointed out, creativity comes from absolute self-discipline. It's a deep thing from within your soul that you have dreams and visions, and your soul desires to invent or dream up and create something. And then you order your body and your mind to carry out that task, and then you will create something wonderful, whether it's Thomas Edison and the light bulb, or Nikola Tesla with direct current, or Beethoven with a symphony, Adolf Hitler as a teenager dreaming of creating the Third Reich, and so forth and so on.
So it's a productive activity, basically.
Yeah, the Jews are slaves to satanic hatreds and lusts. That's the first. The second thing is the love of truth. This is, the Jews invent scams. We invent things that make the world more better and more beautiful. This comes because we love truth. We love reality. We don't believe that lies and shortcuts are the right way to do anything. I mean, this is why it was the Jew Hugh Hefner who came up with Playboy magazine. So basically, you don't need to have a relationship with a real flesh and blood woman and get along with her and understand female psychology and make money and pay the bills and be the papa bear in the family and all the challenges of a real relationship. No, just flip through the pages of Playboy and jerk off. You know, shortcuts which avoid duty, responsibility, and truth. The Aryan is more creative because, well, as I mentioned before, I believe in reincarnation. Aryans come from the other side. We come to this planet and into the physical dimension to face challenges and work on personal issues and grow through hardships and difficulties and embrace them. And I did that when I went to Marine Corps boot camp, and a third of the guys wash out. And these are tough guys, but even the third of the tough guys wash out. It's you decide, I want to grow and stretch and be more of a man or woman than I was yesterday. So the Jew doesn't want to be more of a person. The Jew's goal is to sink to an ever lower level of animal lust and violence and hatred and stealing from others.
Yes, and the Jew also is only concerned about exploiting others' productive activities. And I mean, really, that's what the Jew does. He exploits others. Rather than actually producing something himself, he merely cheats or defrauds or, again, exploits others.
Yes, it's basically a parasitical life form. And their niche, just like the niche of a virus, is to latch onto a healthy organism and actually destroy its DNA. I did the pre-med program at Georgetown University, and I had to take a biology course. I never forgot. One day, they showed on the giant screen the actual outline of what a virus is like. A virus actually looks like a giant spider with legs and with like a bulb at the top.
Mm-hmm.
And it punctures another cell, and this needle goes from the virus right into the nucleus of the other cell, and it kills the DNA of the healthy cell and injects its own DNA into it. So it's destroying the race, the DNA of the healthy cell.
That's how organized Jewry operates.
They have to trick the cell, and they have to trick the policemen in our bloodstream, which are the white blood cells, the leukocytes. The leukocytes are the cops. They noticed a tremor in the force. They noticed something's going on. They sense trauma and trouble, and the white blood cells head towards any puncture or bleeding or inflammation or anything going on in the blood system throughout the whole human body. So what the virus does is it changes its outer surface so it feels like an innocent red blood cell. So the white blood cell bumps up to it, feels a red blood cell, says, oh, false alarm, nothing to see here, and just keeps sailing down the bloodstream. And then as soon as the white blood cell is gone, the virus resumes boring and drilling into a healthy cell. So the Jew pretends to be our friend, pretends to be innocent. In the meantime, he's injecting his DNA into our bloodstream, and he's destroying us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in Mein Kampf, Hitler talks about how the Jew was always the champion of other peoples and other minorities and whatnot. And you see, look what they're doing in America. The Jews are behind homosexuality, all the racial minorities. He's always the champion of the down and out guy. You know what I mean?
Yep, he is the chief. He is.
To destroy the white establishment.
Yeah, and it's not out of love for blacks, for example, or love of homosexuals or love of Mexicans, because he hates them all. But he fears us. He hates all other races and peoples, but he fears us because what Hitler proved in the 12 glorious years of the Third Reich was that when you look at the Northern European, you see this magnificent, creative, self-disciplined entity which excels in every area of the arts and the sciences, of music, poetry, gracefulness, the most beautiful women in the world, because Everybody wants
no
to dump the bones of our white women.
Yes,
know?
No doubt.
You look at it, it's just incredible. And our men, how handsome, our square-jawed, magnificent. The Third Reich was the white race when it was on its game, when it was in the zone under a leader who completely understood the universe. And when we unfolded ourselves and bloomed in that glorious sunshine, it was the 12 years of the Third Reich. We astounded the world in military, in science, in the arts, in human happiness.
Yeah, see, and John, this is the amazing thing. I mean, we literally could be living in a paradise on this planet. If only we understood. I mean, if only we could organize our societies in a manner like Adolf Hitler did. I mean, because I view, you know, National Socialism as fundamentally being in line with the logos or with the ordering of the universe. And when that happens, you get, as you said, you know, we excel in every aspect of life.
Well, we do, because we are the Aryan race consists of advanced souls who have come from the other side into this world to do battle with evil. We were advanced souls before we became white Americans or Germans or Canadians or Australians or Frenchmen. We are here. We have gracefully accepted further tests of our character. And that's why we're here now. And some of us have actually taken the step of becoming a white nationalist, or as I say, a white nationist. And because we believe in a white nation, we're not in a nation, we're not in goose-stepping and conquering other countries. We're interested in creating a healthy, happy, peaceful nation where if somebody doesn't bother us, we don't want to bother any other race. We don't want to exterminate any other decent race of humanity. We want to live and share this planet. And the white race, our presence is good for the other races, for the Chinese and the Japanese and the blacks. We are a blessing to all mankind, but for the things
Absolutely.
We invent and share and spread. It's just the Chinese, the Japanese, they copy everything from us. And they know it, too. They know it, by the way.
That's why blacks certainly don't want to go back to Africa and live with their racial brethren over there. You know what I mean?
Oh, I know it. You know, I was watching, I think it was Chris Rock, and I think Chris Rock is very funny, and he had some comedy once, and he was talking about, you know, back to Africa, and he says, you want to go back to Africa? I don't want to go back to Africa. I know some people have been to Africa. He didn't stay.
No,
I want to stay in America. You would have to offer the average black man $100,000 in cash to accept. Okay, here's the contract. A one-way ticket to Africa, and you must renounce your U.S. citizenship. You'd have to give the average black $100,000 in cash up front before you do it.
Oh, and even then, I don't even know if they'd do it.
I don't even know if they'd do it for $100,000. I mean, which country in Africa would they go to?
Yeah. Well, you know, you were talking about the Aryan spirit, the true nature of the Aryan spirit, and Hitler talks about this idea of idealism. Where you're able to, here, I'll just read a quote real quick. He says, "The greatness of the Aryan is not based on his intellectual powers, but rather on his willingness to devote all of his faculties to the service of the community." So this idea of self-sacrifice and being able to, devote your activities to the benefit of your race is really what the Aryan spirit is all about. But here's the problem. The Jewish media has totally poisoned the true Aryan soul.
Yes, they have. This is why Hitler was absolutely against Christianity bashing, because the belief that you should love your brothers and your sisters, and as Christ said, greater love hath no man than he who layeth down his life for his brothers. Jesus didn't say, lay down your life for your enemies, by the way. Greater love hath no man than he who layeth down his life for his brothers.
Mm-hmm.
Your obligation is to help your brothers and sisters, the people of your own race in your own country, not your enemies. And you can love your enemy, but you still sock them in the mouth. In fact, it may be the loving, it may be a form of tough love to stop an evildoer by clonking him or you may have to execute him. That's actually a form of love to stop an evildoer.
Well, in Hitler, I mean, he viewed Christ as sort of a warrior.
Yes.
You know what I mean? I mean, he didn't view him as some weakling or anything like that, like a lot of white nationalists who like to bash Christianity tend to portray him as.
Exactly, exactly. I've written about this many times. I have a weird karmic connection with the two libraries in America where Hitler's papers in private library are kept. One is the Library of Congress, and Marga, I lived two doors down from a very handsome black man from Louisiana, French name, Cajun man. He was the curator of Hitler's private library at the Library of Congress. It was after World War II, it was all captured. He had books in Berlin. He also had books in the Berghof, you know, in Berchtesgaden up in the Alps, in his Alpine chalet there. He had a lot of books down there, too. In the other place, which is kind of weird, is at Brown University, at the John Hay Library at Brown University, which is on Angel Street, which I grew up in Providence, Rhode Island, where Brown University is. And it's on Angel Street, and my ancestor, Thomas Angel, both my mother and father are descended from Thomas Angel, who came from England to America in 1635. That was all his land, his orchard, and his fields right there, where Brown University is now. So there's a little bit of a connection there. I know the building. I knew everything. And Atlantic Magazine had an article by a Timothy Ryback, a Jew. And the book was Going Through Hitler's Books, Going Through Hitler's Private Books. And these libraries actually had a lot of books. People just sent Hitler. He never read them. He was a busy man. He was the Chancellor of Germany when he was fighting World War II. But some books he did read. And the books about Jesus and religion are heavily written, underlined. Stuff is circled, double underlined, triple underlined, one exclamation point, two exclamation points. Sometimes some parts of the New Testament have like three exclamation points and little marks. And you even find little thin little dark brown hairs off Hitler's head. I guess, you know, you probably scratched or something and, you know, hair fell out. And some between some of the pages, you actually find some of Hitler's hair. And you know that was a book that he was really reading intensely and thinking about and pondering. Hitler was fascinated with the concept of God and religion. Hitler never admitted to being how religious he was, but all his key people, Rudolf Hess, Heinrich Himmler, Haushofer, and many, many other, Dietrich Eckhart, were all members of the Thule Society in Munich, which is all deeply interested in esoteric and metaphysical things. All of Hitler's closest friends were into it. Hitler absolutely believed in life after death and the immortality of the soul, but he didn't talk about it because he didn't want to get into religious discussions at that time. He had enough enemies. He didn't want to get into what happens when we die and should I be a Catholic or a Protestant or should I believe in reincarnation and Hindu stuff like Savitri Devi, and he just didn't want to get into that.
Yeah, and I think it's clear he had a profound respect for the, you know, the organized Catholic Church and the Protestant churches as well, as sort of in providing a moral foundation for society.
Absolutely, and he definitely made it crystal clear to both Martin Bormann and to Heinrich Himmler, no Christian bashing.
Yeah.
No Christian bashing. We may not be Christians in the way that they are, but there's a lot of good and true doctrines in Christianity. About love and forgiveness, shedding the ego, laying down your life for your brothers, which millions of Germans did on the Eastern Front and throughout World War II. And in the Weimar Republic, a thousand stormtroopers died in street battles with the communists, or in some cases, brutal cops. So the values of Christianity and the belief in the soul and in God. And Jesus gave, Adolf Hitler gave a speech on October 24, 1933, and he said, the greatest enemy of Germany is atheism, and I have crushed atheism. The Third Reich is the enemy of atheism. And he meant that. You could not be a member of the SS unless you put down a religious little box, and you either had to put down Protestant or Catholic, or you had to put down, in German the word was Gottgläubig. Gott means God, And gläubig, glaube, is like our word believe. It's related to English and German being similar language. It means God believing.
Yeah.
I believe in God.
Well, see, I think this idea of transcendentalism and a fear of God has really been a bedrock of our race. It's what's made us so great.
Absolutely. The belief that we are not just animals. We may be in human bodies, and we are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just like animals are in heat, we're interested in sex and opposite sex, and we love delicious food, and we grow old and we die like animals. We defecate and urinate, and we're in animal bodies. But we are more than animals.
Yes.
We are spiritual beings taking a human journey.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about this then, because we've seen how effective the Jewish media and the Marxist educational establishment and really this just, communist assault on our civilization has been. And we've seen how Christianity has been totally subverted to where now, mainstream Christianity is more concerned with worshiping the Jews in Israel rather than, sitting down and reading their Bible and reading, for instance, John 8:44, which you talked about earlier. So, I know you're interested in starting a new religion. So what should we get back to? What is your religion all about? And what are some of, its main tenets, I guess?
Well, I've been translating a book by Michael Winkler over in Germany. He's a wonderful comrade. He does a lot of political commentary, but he's also written books based on the reality that there really was something which the great Greek philosopher Plato called Atlantis. And the Hopi Indians also knew there was a great civilization which was destroyed. And the Navajo Indians and the South American Indians and people all around the world know that there was a great civilization. We are Latter-day Atlantean. We are reincarnated Atlanteans. The Roman Empire, the United States, and unfortunately we're making some of the same mistakes as the people of Atlantis in their final days before they were destroyed. Technology out of control, greed, wickedness. The Jews are actually reincarnated Atlanteans as well. There were two factions struggling for power in Atlantis in the final centuries. Edgar Cayce talks about this. One group was called the Sons of the Law of One. Those were the good guys. They wanted to restore the original virtues of family and honor and loyalty to Atlantis because they knew it was decadent and its moral downfall was leading to its economic and military downfall. And Atlantis was hated. And many people left Atlantis and founded other countries and moved away. They emigrated out of it because it became more and more wicked. Like the United States was a virtuous country of pioneers and frontier families, and it's become more and more wicked. The United States is hated as a bully country now by everybody. I mean, even the Canadians hate us, and they like us, but they still hate us. And they see that as a government, this is a bully, out-of-control superpower. So we descend from the Sons of the Law of One. They failed to prevent the moral crash and burning of Atlantis, which is followed by the physical destruction. The Jews descend from the sons of Baal, B-A-A-L. Those sons of Baal worshipped Satan, they worshipped sex, they worshipped money, they worshipped power. They denied that there were any, they believed in the devil, but they didn't believe in God. There's no God, there's just different demons. You got to get in with the demons. And one of the things they were doing, as Edgar Cayce was pointing out, they were drilling deep and violently into the core of the earth after gold and diamonds and various energy resources. And they kept drilling and drilling and drilling and puncturing the crust of the earth until they helped to bring about the great catastrophe which destroyed Atlantis. Atlantis was destroyed in one day. The whole continent sank to the bottom of the ocean. And this is people all around the story in the Bible of Noah and the flood. That's about this. A great civilization which had become wicked is destroyed by the flood waters. It's the same thing as Atlantis. It's the same thing. And all around the world, you have these stories of a great flood.
Mm-hmm.
It really happened. It actually happened.
So again, we're talking about this transcendentalist idea versus this sort of Jewish materialist idea.
Right. What this means is we have animal bodies, but we are just using them to learn and experience things. Because we are relatively young souls. They're very advanced and beautiful worlds. They're beautiful universes to which we have very little access, but we dream of them. Like you have the Greek word Elysium and the word paradise and whatnot. There are paradises for extremely noble and advanced souls. We are here because we need to be in this brutal planet. It's kind of like a Wild West planet. Think of a really great cowboy movie. You have hardworking farmers and ranchers. Then you have the evil cattle baron and his desperados and his tough guys. You have the gunslingers who come into town. It's an extremely dramatic living on the frontier 100 or 150 years ago. You had to be courageous. You had to scrape together your pennies and move out west with a wagon train. You had to fight Indians. You had to fight scumbag white people, too.
Oh, sure.
A lot of bad people
mm-hmm.
who maybe committed a crime in Boston or in Baltimore or in Atlanta, they just skedaddled.
Yeah.
They could be arrested. Next thing you knew, they were out in Kansas City, or they were out in Laramie, Wyoming.
Yeah.
Or they're out in Las Vegas, and
yep.
there's a new guy in town. Well, he doesn't talk much about his past. This guy may have killed somebody back east. So it's sort of a Wild West planet, but this is a planet where you can learn from seeing evil and scum. I know, for example, a lot of people who had a bad childhood, and can you still hear me?
Yeah.
Hello?
Yeah. Sorry, I can still hear you. I had myself on mute there for a second. Yeah, go ahead. I can still hear you.
Okay, good. I just hear a little bit of a dip in the sound. There are people who have a bad childhood, and they decide, I will never treat my kids the way I was treated. So they learn from tragedy. You can learn a lot. You can be the best parent in the world by having a bad childhood.
Yeah.
You can learn from evil.
It's all about growing and learning and developing in this, in this sort of physical realm we're in.
Well, yes. And Joseph Campbell was a great expert on the topic of heroism. And he wrote a book called The Journey of the Hero. Now, the hero is not a berserker. He's not a madman. Foaming at the mouth to get into combat and slay and kill and drink mead. The hero, the village needs somebody to go out and slay the dragon who is demanding that a virgin be sacrificed to him every year. Okay, but everybody's afraid to go to the dragon, go into his cave and confront the dragon with his fiery breath and his scales and his monstrous size. As you walk, as you trudge toward the dragon's cave, you have to face the chilling fear and terror. I'm not up to this. And you see the bones and the skeletons of all those who have failed by the side of the road. He says, the hero is a normal person who dares to dream and hold on to his dream. I will be great. I will be brave. And if I have to, I will lay my life down, but I will take this dragon down with me.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So this earth is a place where you can meet evil villains. And you can't be a hero without a dragon. You can't be a hero without a villain. But the other thing you meet on this planet is you also meet inspiring people. You can read about great heroes. Hitler filled his, as a teenager, read about heroes. He worshipped heroes. Says, I want to be like them. You can meet inspiring teachers and generals and politicians and just people in your own family, uncles and aunts and mentors, and say, I have learned so much from that guy. He's not perfect, but by God, this is a guy who's got a goal, and every day I see the self-discipline, and that this is a man or a woman with a plan. And you can not only learn from the evil, but you can learn from the noble and decide to be like them. So this Wild West planet, just like the frontier days, is a place where you can grow tremendously. And let me just end this little monologue of mine by saying this. Someday the Earth is again going to be a paradise. It's going to be a national socialist paradise. Mm-hmm. It's going to be a world of safety and power and beauty. But you know what? You know what's bad about that? You can only grow 1/30th as rapidly in a peaceful paradise as you can right now. Right now, these dramas force you to grow. They force you to either sink or you swim at a time like this.
Right.
There's going to be a time when everything is predictable and organized and perfect. And there'll be no stress. There'll be no fretting. There'll be no doubts. Nobody will tempt you. There won't be some pedophile trying to show you child porn. There won't be somebody offering you bribes. Nobody will be out there corrupting you. There'll be no temptations to resist at that point. You can go 30 times faster now than you will be able to in the paradise that is coming.
Yeah, I'm reminded of one of my favorite quotes from Mein Kampf, where Hitler says, "He who would live must fight. He who does not wish to fight in this world, where permanent struggle is the law of life, has not the right to exist."
Right, but this is God's
exactly right.
That's God's law for this planet. And if you incarnated after consulting with your angels and you came to this earth, you knew what you were getting into. You knew this is a wild and brutal place, but it's also a place of genuine friendships and where there are brave and bright people with will and skill that are asking you to join them. And you can also get on the upward path, just like me going through Marine Corps boot camp. You know, and you know, we come back from the mess hall, from the cafeteria, and we'd see a few more guys were gone. You know, and then the bed was made, and their duffel bag was gone, and the rifle was gone, and what happened to Lefty? You know, but that fear pushed us. It pushed us. Says, "Oh my God, if I wuss out, if I freak out, if I pussy out, I'm not going to be a Marine. I'm going to be back at the pool hall 3 weeks from now, and my buddy's going to say, 'Hey, what happened to the Marine Corps thing?' He says, 'Yeah, I washed out.'" And that fear was good. So this stressful planet can make you great.
Sure, yeah. Yeah, that's a very positive, uplifting message for sure, and that's what we need more of, you know. Because there is a lot of good in this world. And by focusing on all the negative and you know, getting stuck in this sort of all the negativity, it certainly doesn't allow us to be proactive and to make the moves that we need to do to sort of be the change we want to see in the world. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah. In California, I tell you, your state, I spent so much time in there. California is a beautiful, beautiful state.
It is, man. It's absolutely beautiful.
Gorgeous. There's nothing wrong with California that a good neutron bomb couldn't fix. It's just some of the people there.
Yeah, exactly.
<Need to leave.
laughs> Yeah. Well, I mean, it's not just California. It's the whole country now. It's the whole world, really, nowadays, you know?
Oh, yeah. I mean, California has incredible beaches. I remember once I was waiting on the beach in Santa Monica, and, you know, my ankles were in this beautiful, beautiful water on the beach, and then bikini girls were going by, and muscle men, and, you know, and I saw a palm tree, and behind the palm tree was the snow-capped Mount Baldy. It's just incredible. I mean, California has everything. So we, the white race, need to take back. We know from Salutarianism that white people were the first and true Native Americans. All of the Americans was originally white. We need to take back California and the West Coast, and we need to liberate. We need to do a Reconquista and take back all our land.
There we go. I like
and
that.
Spanish is a wonderful Aryan language. Spain is a white country. I spoke for 2.5 hours to Pedro Varela's group in Barcelona, Spain. I assure you that the true Spanish are all white. They're all blonde and blue-eyed, but they're all white, white-skinned people, a noble people, a brave people. If these Mexicans are so darn proud of you know, their mestizohood, well, then they should be speaking Aztec. That's their native language.
Exactly. Yeah, you know, that's funny that you say that. You know, there's, you can watch YouTube videos of some of these, what do they call them, the brown berets, where they're out there, hey, white people, go back to Europe. She's sitting there saying this, speaking English or Spanish. She doesn't even have her own, you know, unique language. Everything, yeah, everything about her existence is fundamentally shaped by Europeans.
Yeah, if the Aztecs came back to power, they'd be schlepping people like her up to the top of a pyramid,
yeah,
cutting her heart out.
Yeah, I was going to say, she might be sacrificed, yeah.
Yeah, well, you know. You know, I mean, Mexico City, which is so demonic, that when the Spanish just eradicated all the temples, downtown Mexico City is exactly where these blood sacrifice temples were. Just before the Spanish came, and this is all shown in that movie Apocalypto by the great Mel Gibson, they did 10,000 Indians were sacrificed by the Aztecs. So, you know, if they want to turn the clock back to the good old days of the Aztec Empire, well, that would be a form of population control.
Right. Well, see, I think that a big problem is our history has been so distorted. I mean, virtually everything we learn in school has a fundamentally anti-white narrative.
Yeah. Yeah.
So this is a huge problem. You know, our history has been totally distorted. We can't even talk openly and rationally about the concept of race. I mean,
you, who has basically stuck a pin in us like a bug and studied us, he understands you can make white people go on guilt trips.
Oh, yeah.
Tremendous ethical part of their soul. You can tell a white man you're being irresponsible. You're neglecting your duty. Your conscience is weak. You mm-hmm. need to feel bad about letting the world down and being cruel. A Chinaman would just laugh in your face.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
But an Aryan is. Oh my God!
Well, and, you know, John, maybe we can end the program discussing this real quick. You know, the anti-white narrative and the anti-white propaganda is so pathetic. It's really just ridiculous and laughable, but it works. And I'm sure you've been following the Craig Cobb story.
Yeah.
Up in North Dakota, I was driving down the freeway just the other day, and I tuned into NPR. And it's very difficult to listen to NPR. I mean, it's talk about anti-white, you know, Marxist, liberalism, you know, it's just ridiculous.
I was interviewed on NPR.
Oh, were you?
Yeah. I know about them. It wasn't about my racial.
Calling you a white supremacist immediately. I mean, because that's all they were saying about this Craig Cobb guy. It was all that literally they said white supremacist, hater, he's full of hate. I mean, just these. Just these really bogus, you know, meaningless words. And it's like, geez, do people really buy that? I mean, this is acceptable dialogue for people. This is absolutely insulting.
Yeah, basically, they take primitive whites and they have this revolving list of phrases. Hate, white supremacism, violent,
Nazi, yeah,
bigoted, prejudice, virulent, the ADL loves the word virulent. Virulent hatred, you know, it's like it relates to the word virus, virulent. So over and over again, it's interchangeable. It's like a game of Scrabble. You just mix and match, you know.
Well, and it also ties in closely to our totally distorted view of history and how whites are always the oppressors. You know, the evil Nazis murdered all the Jews. They wanted to take over the world. So, I mean, the anti-white propaganda is fundamentally tied to our totally distorted history.
Well, and in point of fact, if truly spiritually advanced white people took over the world, it would be a tremendous blessing for the Asians and the blacks and the Hispanics and everybody. If National Socialism ruled this planet, And Jesse Owens himself said that it was completely untrue that he was disrespected by Adolf Hitler. It's just, if you take a spiritual view of National Socialism, we don't have a black or a white or a green or a yellow soul. We are white because it's a karma to be white, because we love our white people. We came back to help our race.
And that's the problem.
But we don't hate other people.
Yeah.
A white-run planet would be a green garden paradise where everybody would be happy and all races.
Well, see, John, this is the thing, because we are always on the defensive. You know what I mean? You know, pro-white people, people that care about the white race, we're always on the defensive. We're always made to seem like we hate other races, when in fact, we love our own race and we care about the future of our own race. We don't hate other races. I mean, I'm literally still trying to find somebody in this movement that genuinely hates black people or Mexicans. I mean, people just don't really this is just not really how people think. You know, people may be upset with, you know, the black-on-white crime and you know, the all the illegal Mexicans and whatnot. But it's not like we hate these people. We just recognize the racial differences and sort of the racial conflicts that go on.
Well, I mean, the real thing is we need to hate psychopaths, and there's psychopaths in all races. These are people who are natural-born human devils and sadists. There was three blacks just went on trial in South Africa for a horrific crime. I read about it, I guess, a year ago, and finally they went to trial. And they shot the husband, they raped the wife and mother, and then they plunged the little boy, screaming little boy, into they filled up the bathtub with boiling water and boiled it to death.
I heard about this story as well. Sickening.
That is their the real problem is the psychopaths in all races. I believe that at least 5% of all whites are psychopaths. I think 20% of blacks are psychopaths, but 80% aren't. I believe 50% of Jews are psychopaths, but 50% aren't. I mean, I accidentally dated two girls who turned out to be Jewish. I broke it off at that point.
You'll notice.
You know, she had blonde hair and blue eyes. She was Lithuanian Jewish. But
and the problem,
if you could take the Jews out of their culture, the psychopathic culture, 50% of the Jews could be turned around, 80% of the blacks could be, doesn't mean they'd be rocket scientists, doesn't mean their IQ would grow, but most people are not psychopaths.
Well, and see, the problem is I think most of the leaders in the world today are, in fact, psychopaths. You know what I mean? Psychopaths sort of rise to the top and rise to positions of power.
Exactly. And we have, look, the Jews would be nothing and nobody. That bunch of scrawny, nasty, ugly little effers. But it's the white collaborators that they corrupt that do their bidding.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a white man that hanged the Nuremberg war crimes trials named Sergeant John Wood. He was a nice white man.
Yeah. You know,
it's white men who do the Jews' bidding.
Well, we fall either victim to the Jewish propaganda or we're compromised in some way.
Yeah.
You know, that's sort of the story of our race the past couple hundred years.
Yeah, I mean, nobody's ever claimed Bill Clinton was a crypto Jew or anything. He was very, very Scotch-Irish looking, very Aryan looking guy. But the Jews have an eagle eye out for any young charismatic guy with no character and a lot of charm and a good mouth that they can corrupt. Okay, this Bill Clinton, yeah, he likes women. Okay, so that's, we'll get him with women. You know, that he's got a sex addiction. We'll provide him with women. He's going to have constant sex scandals, and we'll blackmail him and we'll control him through that. So they study and promote bright, charismatic, goy white leaders who have skeletons in the closet. They love the skeletons in the closet.
Yeah, I mean, I think that you pretty much have to be compromised in order to even rise to power in the United States today.
Yeah, exactly. And
I mean, you have to be in on it, sort of.
On my blog, I talk about all the problems that I've had in my life. Like I was molested as a kid, or that both of my children have turned their back on me because I'm a National Socialist. Or I found out about my dad's death from a member of his church. I was disinherited and thrown out of the family totally. I talk about poverty. I've got some unpaid utility bills. You know, I talk about all the bad things that have happened in my life. So nobody can say, well, you're hiding something.
Yeah.
And people say, well, you talk too much about your life. And I say, that's so nobody can blackmail me.
Speaking of, John, I just had some guy leave a comment on my website. Yeah. Saying, oh, hey, does John DeNugent know you have a mixed-race daughter? If not, I'm going to tell him and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, well, yeah, we've talked about this privately numerous times, and I'm not trying to make this some secret, okay? So calm down.
What a rectal, what a rectal orifice. I hate that. The fact of the matter is, I've had many friends who were Asians. The mother of your child is a Filipina. The Asian race is hardworking and intelligent. In fact, they score 5 IQ points on average above white people.
I think like generally speaking, yeah, that is definitely true.
Yeah, I mean, I used to tutor Japanese and Chinese at MIT because they had a problem speaking with an understandable American accent because their languages are very different. They have different sounds. Japanese only has 1/3 as many sounds as English, in fact. So many English words, they don't even have a problem. You know, I mean, lots of luck, you know. All the Asians have problems. But they're hardworking. They have a strong sense of family and discipline. They're not whiners. And they're very stolid. The Asian race is stolid. They don't tend to whine and complain and cry and bellyache. There's good things about the Asian race. So now you get involved with an Asian girl. Well, so what? It's not as if you had sex with an animal or something. The Asians are a very high race. I believe our race has even more strengths than the Asian race. But the Asian race, look at China and Japan today. They are very advanced people.
Mm-hmm.
So you made a mistake, but so what? I've made mistakes, and this guy is just hiding his mistakes.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I mean,
and how many white
people part of the problem is there's such a – in this whole movement, there's way more conflict and competition rather than collaboration. And that seems to be a big problem just, you know, with everybody out there doing their thing.
Well, this is why we need the spirit that Christ preached of brotherhood and shed the ego and don't be envious. I know some people hate me just because they say, well, John Nugent's, he's brighter or better looking or whatever than I am, and so I hate his guts. I say, you know, envy is one of the mortal sins in the Catholic Church.
Well, the 7 deadly sins.
Seven deadly sins. But if it's the most pointless. I mean, if you rape or steal or murder or steal, you know, you at least you get something out of it. But what do you get out of envying somebody? You hate them because they're happy, or you hate them because they have some talent. You know, what does that do for you? I mean, it's the most pointless, and it's widespread, unfortunately. And this is where the Jew is winning. We have got to beat, as the early National Socialists said, the inner Jew, our own inner Jew.
Ah, that's true. Yeah, that's definitely true.
Make sure we're not Jews inside. I mean, the Jews are full of hate. Are we a, quote, what in quote, white nationalists because we hate blacks or hate Jews or hate homosexuals or Mexicans or in Europe, the big thing is the Muslims, you know, that they are the bane of their existence over there. We got Mexicans here, but man, they got Turks and Arabs over there and Somalians, which are how wonderful,
oh,
they're black and Muslim and hyper-violent. We got a few of them here. We got them in Minnesota. We got them in Maine, too, and some other areas.
Yep.
So we're starting to get a Muslim problem here. But the point is your definition of white nationalism, all these other races that I hate, because they harmed me or ruined my neighborhood or they bullied me in high school, so I hate them. That's not building a white nation. That's not love. That's not building or rebuilding our traditions and our music and our families. That's what white nationism is. Building or the phoenix rising from the ashes and creating a new and more glorious National Socialist white nation.
Well said. Okay, well, let's go ahead and wrap up. I don't know, did you have any concluding remarks about Spengler versus Hitler, which was kind of the main discussion we've kind of jumped all over. But I don't know if you had any final conclusions on that subject or just, you know, in general, anything we've talked about today.
Well, yeah, Spengler was brilliant, and so was Nietzsche and all these others. Basically, we must understand that there is a cycle of the rise and fall of civilizations, but a civilization doesn't have to completely crash and be disturbed. It can go through, as the 23rd Psalm says, yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I shall fear no evil, for thou, meaning God, art with me. So we will go through this dark night. We will not abandon our country and our race, and we will get out of this pit of blackness, and we will go through the tunnel and come out into the light.
Very well said. Very well said. Well, thanks, John. It's been a fascinating conversation.
Thank you, brother.
Yeah, we'll definitely have to do this again. So we'll go ahead and wrap up today, guys. Thanks for tuning in. This is John Friend signing off on this Tuesday, September 24th, 2013 edition of The Realist Report. I am not sure if I'm going to be doing a show tomorrow, so stay tuned to the TalkShoe page, and I will also post details on Facebook. So thanks again, everybody. And, John, I will talk to you soon.
Okay, take care, John. Bye-bye.
Okay.